Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. The House furiously debates the GOP health reform plan. Jason Lewis of Minnesota says,
Mr. Speaker, I rise today in support of the American Health Care Act, and I ask the other side, just what is it you are trying to preserve by voting no? Premiums rising double digits for years, for the last 7 years?
Congressman Seth Moulton says he's trying to preserve Massachusetts' 97% coverage rate, and he quotes a letter from a constituent.
This constituent is the Republican governor of Massachusetts, who knows that Trump care destroys our ability to ensure access to quality, affordable health care coverage.
That and much more in our Week in Review. Also today, a conversation with the award-winning actress Sheree Agdashloo.
The day I left Iran, right at the time of the turmoil, before the revolution, I turned myself into an actress with a mission.
All that coming up next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, and the fight over the Republican health care reform plan gets more intense by the minute as the House could begin its vote this hour.
Americans were told that Obamacare would bring down prices and increase options. You were told that you could keep your plan and keep your doctor. You were given many, many false stories. The fact is, you were given many lies. Go with our plan. It's going to be terrific.
Frankly, at this point, it's not a question of negotiating anymore. It's understanding the greater good that's at hand. The president understands this is it. We had this opportunity. There's no question, in my mind at least, that the president and the team here have left everything on the field.
There are only two ways you can vote for this bill. One is you don't know what's in the bill. Or two is you have to have a heart of stone. Because this bill is shameful. It's going to hurt people. It's going to hurt your constituents. Withdraw this bill or vote no on this bill, but this bill cannot become law.
You just heard Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern, also White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, and President Donald Trump speaking yesterday via a Twitter video. Now, in a moment, we're going to turn to our Week in Review panel, but first, let's go straight to Washington and hear from Sahil Kapoor, senior political reporter at Bloomberg Politics. He's been closely watching all the developments on the Hill today. Sahil, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, does the House have enough votes to pass the American Health Care Act?
At this point, they do not. Leadership has been working the last tools in their quiver all day trying to whip the votes. And what we've seen is the other direction. We've seen some more moderates since last night come out and say they can't vote for this bill. So at this point, it does not look like they have the votes. There is consideration right now as to whether they even hold the vote at all, because this thing could fail more spectacularly if people know that it's going down. A lot of people are soft yeses, both on the moderate flank and on the right. And if they know this bill is going to fail, this could fail pretty badly. So that's the dilemma they're facing right now.
There's been so many ups and downs and competing statements about this bill over the course of the day. At one point in time, the White House was saying the vote was going to happen at 3:30. At another point in time, people were saying it was going to happen a half an hour later. Then a little earlier today, House Speaker Paul Ryan visited the White House. Do we know if he saw the president and what, if anything, he told Donald Trump?
Indications we have are that he did meet with the president. There's reporting out there. I don't believe we have confirmed independently that he told the president he doesn't have the votes and asked if he should pull the bill. We have not heard from the speaker's office since then. And so far, Republican leadership had planned on voting at the end of this hour or next hour. We have not had an update yet. We will find out soon. They're
now
in a difficult position.
Sahil, last night, White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney told House Republicans that if the bill does not pass today, President Trump would move on and leave Obamacare in place, that he had all sorts of other priorities that he wanted to work on. What impact did that message have amongst GOP House members, if any?
My sources in the room tell me that it did move a few people to yes, including some in the House Freedom Caucus, but not enough. That message moved some Freedom Caucus people to yes, as did one of the new provisions they added to the bill, which is repeal of the essential health benefits in the Affordable Care Act, which is basically 10 things that insurance companies are mandated to cover in every policy. But it also had the effect of alienating some moderates, including House Appropriations Committee Chairman Rodney Frelinghuysen, which is quite an ominous sign, I would say, for Republican leadership, because you don't usually lose committee chairman in a big vote like this. They tend to be allies of leadership. It sounds like Mr. Mulvaney was Republicans an ultimatum, saying if you really want to repeal and replace Obamacare, this is your shot. You need to vote yes.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more from White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer today from the Daily Briefing, where he said, as maybe folks have been seeing bubbling up on media, that he says that the president has put everything out there. Let's listen.
You know, the president is confident that we have done every single thing possible, made the case, updated it, added, and done everything to listen to the concerns and to do everything that fulfills the promises that we and members have made with the American people.
Now, Sahil, Donald Trump ran during his campaign as the quintessential negotiator. He said he was going to make amazing deals for America. What does it say that it seems at this moment, who knows, things could change, but it seems at this moment, whatever pressure, whatever negotiating tactics, whatever promises and changes the president said would be made to the bill are not enough to move the needle on the number of votes they need?
That is the way it looks right now. And look, let's be clear. It's always possible that Republican leadership pulls a rabbit out of the bag, that some miracle happens and they end up getting the votes. But right now, all indications are they do not have them. To your point about the president and his negotiating skills, this is one of the reasons this is going to be a pretty embarrassing setback if it fails. Not only has the president touted his negotiating skills as spectacular and unusual and one of the reasons he should have been elected president to begin with, but Republican leadership members and their senior staffers have been promoting the president as the closer, the ultimate closer, the deal maker, things like that. They had rested their hopes on getting this across the finish line on him. Republican leadership always knew that there was a certain flank in their caucus that wouldn't be persuaded by them. They like to stand up to congressional leadership and say that, you know, and take an anti-establishment position. But they don't necessarily want to be against the president because he's particularly popular in these very conservative districts. Hmm. It seems like that wasn't enough to get the job done, though.
I'm looking at two tweets from Newt Gingrich here. A little earlier today, he tweeted, "No one should be confused. Obamacare repeal, if it passes, will be Trump's triumph. He personally intervened to save the bill when it faced defeat." Then 8 hours later, Newt Gingrich again tweets, "Why would you schedule a vote on a bill that is at 17% approval? Have we forgotten everything Reagan taught us?" I'm wondering, I mean, that seems to be the perfect description of the problem maybe not Donald Trump faces, but Paul Ryan faces. I mean, if this vote doesn't happen or if the bill doesn't pass, what impact is it going to have on Ryan's speakership?
Firstly, it sounds like the former Speaker Gingrich, from the two tweets you read, sounds like he's trying to have it a bit both ways. On the one hand, promoting this bill as he did a few days ago, he called it a big step forward, not perfect, but much better than Obamacare. This is a tweet by him dated March 21st. Now, I think he's tweeting it on the basis that it seems likely to fail, and he's bringing this up. For Ryan's position right now, what this means, it's far from clear. What we heard from a White House spokesman, Sean Spicer, in the last 2 hours is that the Speaker and the President have been working closely on this. The President left everything on the field. The Speaker did everything he can. There's no indication that the White House, at least publicly, at least on the record, is blaming Speaker Ryan for this failing. Now, if that changes, if the President himself decides to put the blame squarely at the feet of Speaker Ryan, that could make for a very interesting dynamic. As far as I know, Speaker Ryan is pretty safe in that position because, frankly, there is no alternative, and the people who oppose him most do not have a candidate who will get anywhere near the kind of consensus he has in the Republican conference.
Interesting. Well, I'm seeing here that Representative David Joyce, who met with the president on Wednesday night, said he's going to vote against the bill. Representative Barbara Comstock of Virginia, a longtime friend of Paul Ryan and an ally, also, I believe, says that she's going to vote no on the bill. So we'll see what happens here. Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics, speaking to us from Washington. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
When we come back, we'll pick up the question about health care reform with our Week in Review panel, so stick with us. I'm Meghan Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And as we heard, any time this hour, maybe the House could hold its vote on the Republican health care reform plan. Debate on the House floor today was rather intense. Here's some tape. Republican Jason Lewis, congressman from Minnesota. Here he is speaking on the House floor today.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today in support of the American Health Care Act. And I ask the other side, just what is it you are trying to preserve by voting no? Premiums rising double digits for years, for the last 7 years. Young, healthy people being priced out of the insurance market. That is the genesis of the death spiral in the insurance markets. That's what this bill is trying to correct.
Well, in order to answer that question about just what it is you are trying to preserve by voting no, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton spoke, and he pointed to one of his own constituents.
I'd like to read a message from a Republican constituent. Quote, the American Health Care Act would strain the fiscal resources necessary to support the Commonwealth's continued commitment to universal health coverage. This constituent is the Republican governor of Massachusetts, who knows that Trump Care destroys our ability to ensure access to quality, affordable health care coverage.
That's Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton in House debate earlier today. That debate, which is continuously going on right now. And again, if the House does take its vote anytime this hour, we'll let you know what happens. But as we wait for that, let's go to our Week in Review panel. Susan Tracy, former Democratic state representative from Alston-Brighton and president of the consulting firm The Strategy Group. Great to have you, Susan.
Thanks, Meghna.
Also with us today, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Good to see you, Jim.
It's good to be with you.
Where do we begin? Susan, your thoughts on this melee?
You know, I have to say, I am kind of listening to it all, and I don't know which direction to go in with observations on this. You know, I think if I just sort of peeled back one thought, I would say it certainly feels like this is not going to pass. And, you know, if you have to pick winners and losers, I think the poor people and middle class people and elderly people and people who need health care will be the winners, because the policy might need some changes today, but it certainly doesn't need repeal and a replacement with something that rips so many things away from people.
You know, Jim, I mean, there have been bills in the past that haven't really pleased everyone, but those have been good bills because it means everyone had to compromise. This bill seems to please no one, but many people think that it's because there's a lot of bad in it.
Yeah, it doesn't have a very high approval rating out there. I guess the initial thing I thought of when I was listening to the conversation with Sahil is I feel really unexciting. Whatever I'm going to say is going to be really unexciting compared to this like melee that's
going on in Washington,
in D.C.
Yeah.
You know, I guess my thoughts go to on this one. I wonder what happens if it fails, if they do bring it to a vote and it fails. I agree that there's no other alternative besides Speaker Ryan, but he will limp along as Boehner did for quite some time. And you wonder within the White House, because there is some palace intrigue there as well, does it weaken Priebus, who hasn't been able to line up the votes, and that's his job? So does it strengthen Steve Bannon? I mean, all those sort of dynamics are at play. And I guess the next what follows is kind of anyone's bet.
Susan, you want to jump in?
Yeah, can I just say, you know, I found myself thinking about, you know, what happens with the relationship between the White House and Congress, because they, you know, if they're going to get an agenda done, they need each other. I think this is very damaging to the relationship between the White House, not just in Ryan, but in all members, because I'd be willing to bet that Donald Trump will not take the fall for this if it crashes.
I'd say he could make an argument no matter what happens that he comes out a winner.
Correct. And if he does, if you're in that Congress, you realize he is only concerned about himself, and he is not someone who is honorable to work with. And I think it could really damage the relationship between the Congress and the White House.
Well, and Sahil touched on this. I mean, when you think about who's facing re-election first, it's all of those House members, right? Like, they have to go back to their districts, possibly even this weekend, and explain what happened. Yeah. And that's got to be a daunting challenge to face, Jim.
No, I think it definitely is. And I would say, look, I don't think Trump would take the fall, but I think of the political calculus is if he does in any way give in after this, it reduces his, it diminishes his negotiating power with the House for everything for the next 4 years. So he could just say, we'll just stick with Obamacare. We'll do the regulatory fixes, do some fixes to it. You guys had your chance. Let's move on to tax cuts. That was my first thing anyways. I really wanted to do that, right? I mean, it could be a really interesting thing that happens where Obamacare does, in this case, again, limp along and they try to do some little fixes on the financial side.
One thing I would say to that, Jim, is you're speaking like someone who cares about policy. And
I
don't think Donald Trump
cares
about any of these things, possibly the tax cuts. But other than that, I don't know that he actually cares if the things fail. Mm-hmm. I don't.
You know what? I was remembering that when President Obama first took office and not long thereafter, he tried to wrap his arms around health care. He was, later on, he was widely criticized. Like, why take on this giant, unwieldy, difficult thing when there was possibly lower hanging fruit for a Democrat who had a Democratic Congress at the beginning of his tenure could have done? I feel like the Republicans have walked into that very same trap, haven't they?
I think he's walked them into it, too. And I think he's
by making
walk.
All those promises on the
I
campaign
do,
trail.
And I think he's and repeal and replace. I mean, the original plan was right. You're kind of slowly going to get there. You're going to get past the midterm elections, and that he pushed. We got to repeal and replace in the same.
I mean, but to be fair, he wasn't the only one who said it. The entire House GOP had been saying that for years.
Yeah, but they don't listen to them the same way.
I probably disagree on that. I think if you did tax cuts and other things, let's say waited to the second year, I don't think you'd have the leverage over these folks to do health care. Health care is so hard. And for 7 years, the Republicans have been talking about, we've got a plan, we're cooking the plan, we're stirring the plan, we're adding salt and pepper. And look, the fact is, if they can't do it now, when they really want to have the president as an ally for all the other things they really, really want, I don't know when they could do it. So I think this just kind of calls the bluff on the Republicans that if they can't get something to move forward on health care now, they weren't going to be able to do it at any point.
Well, I want to get to potential impacts here in Massachusetts in just a minute here. But there's another question I have about you were talking about a chasm, Susan, mm-hmm. a little earlier between the White House and congressional Republicans. I mean, was that chasm in a certain way inevitable, if it indeed is opening now? Because Donald Trump ran on Trumpist populism, whatever, however we want to define that. And that is not necessarily or at all the kind of Republicanism that many members of the House, let alone Paul Ryan, ever espoused to. So to me, part of this feels inevitable.
A little bit. I also think the thing to watch there is his popularity numbers. Because I think if he's very popular, you want him near you. We've seen that always with presidents, right? When someone's popular, they're flying in and doing events for you. When they're not, you're busy that day when they're in town.
I mean, this is happening right now when Trump does have historically low approval numbers.
Right. So it's much easier to pull away from him at these times. But I agree with you. He's a different kind of president. If he's strong, they'll want him. If he's weak, they'll run.
Jim?
I'd just say, look, the Freedom Caucus is a group of legislators that does not like to compromise. So that they wouldn't compromise with President Trump is no surprise at all. And I think anyone who looked at this would expect that to have to happen.
Can I offer you one other thought on that?
Please.
I think we're all focused on the Freedom Caucus. But remember, every time you try to please the Freedom Caucus, obviously you move further away from the middle. There are 23 members of Congress who are up for re-election in 2018 for whom Hillary Clinton won their district. So voting with Trump. So I think we focus on the Freedom Caucus, but when you appease them, you're going to lose that other group of people.
Well, let's talk about some of the reaction that we've been hearing over the course of the week here in Massachusetts to what the potential impacts could be if this bill does pass. I mean, again, the House has not yet taken its vote. They could at any moment now. On Tuesday, Governor Baker spoke with reporters. Now, he actually wrote a letter to Washington to the delegation outlining the potential impacts that Massachusetts could feel with the Republican health reform plan, primarily losing $1 billion beginning in 2020. Here's what the governor said to reporters on Tuesday.
I think the goal for us and for others is going to be to work like mad to make sure that the Commonwealth of Mass can continue to do what we've been doing, which is providing coverage to 97% of our population.
Jim, so let me start with you. I mean, Massachusetts has kind of a unique position in all this with our high coverage rate and that first-in-the-nation health reform plan we have here in the state. What do you make of the kind of dire outlook that Baker provides if the plan passes?
He's right. Look, we stand to lose between $500 million and $1 billion immediately, right? And that's a big deal. But what I would say is the impact, and this might be somewhat controversial, what I'm about to say, but the Affordable Care Act actually had a negative impact on our system here in Massachusetts in the sense that we ended up seeing the result of that being lots of people pushed into Medicaid. About 1.95 million people in Massachusetts out of 6.6, about 29% of our population, is now on Medicaid, a program that was for the indigent originally. That's not great care. A lot of doctors don't want to see them, and it is a huge budget buster. Now, 57% of our budget's Health and Human Services, or within the Health and Human Services realm, largely Medicaid, and it is eating our seed corn. People are not getting great care. So it's not as if things are that great here, by the way, in terms of trends. We are deeply worried about the budgetary impact. And that's why, frankly, Governor Baker's also chasing an assessment on businesses right now because he can't square the budget.
Right. He wanted to do that $2,000 right. additional tax.
Yep.
You say pushed into Medicaid. Others call it Medicaid expansion, which is what allowed coverage for people who were previously uninsured.
No, but we had a 97% coverage rate before there were that many people went into Medicaid through the connector and other means, and we've seen lots of move to Medicaid, and we haven't
because
pushed up the numbers.
Yeah, their employers didn't necessarily offer them the care, the insurance.
That's really unclear at this point. We've asked for data on that. We've not been able to get clear data on it. So I'm open to it, but it's really hard to know.
Susan?
You know, I think Jim makes some good points there. The one thing I would say is what I think is fundamentally different about what's happening here is it's a serious conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really trying to, you know, meeting with the business leaders and trying to assess a, you know, some type of a fee, tax, whatever the right words are to call it to make it okay to do, to address a problem and to have a goal of having people insured at 97%,
Amen.
If not 100, is where we should be. So that makes me feel good about our state.
Hmm. Well, let's play a little bit more tape here. This is Congresswoman Catherine Clark. We spoke with her just yesterday. And again, we asked her about what she's going to vote no, along with the entire rest of the congressional delegation from Massachusetts. But she told us specifically what worries her about the proposed Republican reform plan.
What we're seeing is them moving on the wrong direction for Americans. Instead of making this bill better, they are continuing to look to do further cuts. And we think the damage they've already done is quite enough when 24 million Americans are looking at losing their health care under this proposal.
Now, Susan and Jim, before we move away from the breathlessness of health care reform, let me ask you, we don't know how this vote is going to go. It could happen at any time. But if the House votes down the Republican reform plan, there are still major aspects of it which resonate very powerfully with Americans. And there's legitimate criticisms of Obamacare. One that many point to is insurers leaving the exchanges, the other being high deductible plans and it getting tougher for people to afford it. Jim, you pointed to, at the state level, the budget busting qualities of the continuous rise in cost of health care. None of these things are going to go away.
Right.
I'm just wondering, what would you advise next steps be in Washington? Can Washington sort of recover to the point where they do something specific about these problems?
If we could get out of this partisan nonsense that we're in, which is creating this dynamic that, Obamacare is so horrible, it's the worst thing. It's ridiculous. Your points are well taken. There are some problems with it. If the goal was to, have people have health care and take care of the needy and make sure that it was affordable, if those were real goals and people worked together to address them, just as we talked about the attitude in Massachusetts being that way, that's, to me, the only way to really address it. You have to stop pretending that it's the horror, and you have to also say what's wrong with it and be willing to fix it. I don't think in this climate that's going to happen. I think it's so partisan and so divided, and the people and the desire to help people is just lost in all of this, sadly.
I think there's one good thing that's happened over the past, say, half year, and that is a lot of folks on the left have joined folks on the right in saying, hey, you know what, maybe state-based solutions are a really good thing. Give us some freedom to do stuff. So I'll give you one example. The Massachusetts Health Reform in 2006 passed. It said that if your employer provided insurance to you, you had to take it. You couldn't just go onto Medicaid or some other service. That was done away with the Affordable Care Act. I think we should ask for a waiver on that. We should go back to a state requirement that if you're, if Pioneer Institute, I offer my employee insurance, you got to take it. And you can't just go onto a public program. I think that's probably a place to start to make sure that we don't start crowding out folks as much. Even though I have to say my premiums just went up 26% this year.
Wow. Well, you know, once again, you sound like someone who actually cares about health policy, right. Jim. I've always found it interesting that that folks turn back to states' rights and state solution when their party doesn't necessarily hold all the strings in Washington.
Well, I'm always consistent. I think we should have more of that.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eye on what's happening in Washington the rest of this hour. But let's move on to another major story that happened here in Massachusetts this week. And that one has to do with the verdict out of federal court in Boston involving the former co-owner of the New England Compounding Center, the NECC. Now, for those who don't remember, back in 2012, the NECC was this Framingham-based compounding company that was behind a nationwide fungal meningitis outbreak that killed 64 people and sickened almost 700. This week, the company's co-owner, Barry Cadden, was found not guilty on the most serious charges of second-degree murder charges, but he was convicted on other lesser charges, including racketeering and fraud. Here's his lawyer, Bruce Signal, speaking just after the verdict was handed down.
It is a disgrace that he was charged with murder. It was unprovable, unwarranted, and unjustified. And we are deeply grateful that the jury saw it that way.
Well, we also spoke with one of the victims of the meningitis outbreak, Army Major Adam Ziegler. And here's what he told us. He said that he does believe some justice was served in this case.
As far as, you know, whether it's anyone's ever going to be made whole in this, or whether if he'd have been found guilty of 25 counts of second-degree murder, if it would make me feel any better, it really wouldn't matter. He's going to be punished, and all the rest of us are still going to have to go on with our lives as wherever we are, either without somebody or, you know, dealing with whatever pain or injury we have for the rest of our lives.
Susan, your reaction to the verdict?
You know, this is the worst medical disaster by negligence that I have ever seen in my life. I just remember at the time, I mean, 64 people, hundreds with permanent, you know, medical conditions. I get the emotion on this one. I also have served on a jury before. I don't know if anyone else has in this group. Certainly listeners have. And I understand why the jurors probably came to the place that they did to actually call this murder. Mm. You know, a conviction for greed, I think, would be an easy conviction. But I am sympathetic to what the jurors were deciding and where they came out.
Jim?
You remember the old classic film, The Third Man?
Yeah.
Harry Lime? This is Harry Lime in modern form, right?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. This is, there was tainted penicillin that led to meningitis deaths and people being maimed. And remember his comments about the Borgias and not caring about the dots. Mm. It's troubling. I mean, look, I get it. I get it's hard to convict someone for murder. I get that. But this is there's conspiracy involved in here. There's the use of expired drugs. I mean, if you're running a facility where you're essentially manufacturing, it's not a pharmacy. It's like a pharmaceutical company / pharmacy where they mix in a custom way all the medications, you know the risks. And it's really troubling that his lawyer would come out and say he was really concerned about the victims.
Yeah. You know, it makes me wonder about whether or not the prosecutors overreached here in with those 25 second-degree murder charges. Because, I mean, look, people did die.
It's horrible.
But he was found not guilty on all 25 of them, and now that might affect, you know, a prosecution in an upcoming case related to what happened at NECC. Do you think they overreached?
You know, I don't know. I don't have enough information in front of me to make that call. But as I said, I look at it from a juror's perspective, and I think I could understand how they got to that place.
Hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that we talked about on the show this week was whether or not the regulatory gap that the NECC fell into between state and federal regulators has been closed since 2012. And we spoke with Kevin Ouderson. He's Boston University's health law. He's the co-director of the health law program there, and he actually also served on a special Massachusetts commission that was formed to investigate compounding pharmacies after the 2012 outbreak. And to be perfectly honest, he told us a couple of troubling things. One of them was that a bill passed by Congress after the outbreak actually left FDA regulation of compounding pharmacies up to the pharmacies themselves to choose. I mean, depending on point of view, you might think that that's a good or bad decision, but that's what happened. And he also believes that we're not necessarily safer now than we were in 2012. Here he is.
In the immediate aftermath, Massachusetts did a good job. But I think the question is, you know, where is there a compounding pharmacy someplace in this country right now that's not meeting standards, and how would we know? And would you know when the doctor's about to give you an injection exactly where that drug came from and whether it was FDA regulated or not?
He told us basically the only way to know is to ask. But, you know,
wow.
Who do you ask?
Who do you ask?
What do you
right?
What do you think about that, Susan?
It terrifies me, actually. I'm glad I don't have to take injections on a regular basis. If I did, I think I'd be really concerned about that statement.
Jim?
It all lies in the inspection regime, that you actually have a full and regular inspection regime. If we don't have that in place, I mean, how can you actually trust what you're putting in your
you
body?
Bet.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap up with one piece which I'm going to categorize as good news here in Boston, and that's because Boston Public Schools announced just yesterday that Boston Latin School has a new headmaster. She's a native of Dorchester and a BLS alumna herself, Rachel Skerritt. She's currently Deputy Chief of Leadership Development for the District of Columbia Public Schools. She will be the first person of color ever to lead the historic exam school. And she spoke yesterday with WBUR and said this.
I was at Latin School from the time I was 11 to the time I was 17. Those are critical growth years. And they also are years that you engage in some difficult conversations and experiences, oftentimes about equity and race. And I definitely had my share of those at Latin School, inside and outside of the classroom.
Jim, it's been a long 18 months or so for Boston Latin. What do you make of Rachel Skerritt as the new headmaster?
Look, she has an incredible resume, and I just add one thing that hasn't come up in terms of her resume, and that is she also taught at BLS as a seventh grade teacher. She won an award for her teaching. Look, if you're started over a video and amplified well beyond that, right? And I think the school has been trying to grapple with that. I called a couple of BLS parents to ask them what they thought this morning, and I would say it's not just the mayor, it's not just the superintendent, it's not just Mike Contempasas on an interim basis running the school. People are thrilled that they have someone of this caliber coming in.
I had the same reaction. I have a young guy who works with me who is a Boston Latin School, a proud Boston Latin School alum, and he said, she's going to be great. People are really happy. The young alumni are really excited about it. And what did he say to me? He said she'll appreciate the traditions, but she won't be afraid to make some changes too.
Yeah. Well, we'll wish her all the best, and of course, keep a close eye on what she accomplishes when she begins at Boston Latin, which we're not quite sure yet, because we also have to remind ourselves that she has a 3-month-old little kid. So very full hands for Rachel Skerritt. All right, we've got just enough time for your quick hubbubs, because let's have a little bit of lighter news to end the week. Susan?
My favorite story this week was the return of the Tom Brady shirts, gotta say. And not just
an
one.
FBI success.
Yeah, not just one, but two shirts. Who knew? I thought that was exciting. Kind of a little bit of extra, you know, humor for me that they were in Mexico and they didn't have to throw them on over a wall for us to get them back. And I thought that was a fun story. Something light and enjoyable in a week with a lot going on.
Yeah.
Those were bad hombres.
Yeah.
Listen, mine is a story way, way below the upper fold of the front page. It's non-news, really. It's that we're all getting old. And if you need evidence...
Hey, what?
Yeah, you are. Just listen to this.
I'm just going to be quiet now.
Even Johnny Lydon, known in the day as Johnny Rotten, in addition to the wrinkles, the weight around the midriff, the fraying of his once melodious voice, well, maybe not, he revealed to the British press that he will, quote, sorely miss the Queen when she dies. He noted further.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
He noted further that he enjoys the pageantry surrounding the royal family, and he said, long may she live. Now, you can't spit that one out into a microphone.
Johnny Rotten said that?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Age does mellow people out. Okay, well, my hubbub is actually some news, some breaking news right now, because we're seeing multiple media outlets are reporting, including the Associated Press and NPR, that there will not be a vote on the health care bill today. In fact, House Speaker Paul Ryan just now, just a couple of minutes ago, put out this tweet, quote, "I'll give an update on health care reform at 4 p.m. So coming up in about 20 minutes, Robert Costa, who's the national political reporter for The Washington Post, sent out a tweet saying, Trump just called me. We just pulled it. He tells Robert Costa, I don't blame Paul. CNN is saying that the health care bill is being pulled at the president's request. So once again, House Speaker Paul Ryan saying, I'm going to give an update on the health care reform bill at 4 o'clock. And lots of reporting saying there will not be a vote on the Republican health reform plan today. So another day. We'll see what happens tomorrow. Susan Tracy, former state representative and president of the Strategy Group, thanks so much.
Thanks, Magna.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute, thank you as well.
It's good to be with you.
Back in a moment. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. Iranian-born Shireh Aghdashloo is an award-winning actress who surprises. Right now, she's got a powerful role in the Sci-Fi Channel's epic series, The Expanse, which you'll hear more about in a minute. You've probably come across some of her prestige projects, including the 2003 film House of Sand and Fog, which she stars in alongside Ben Kingsley. Aghdashloo plays Nadi, an immigrant who flees Iran with her husband, played by Kingsley, during the Iranian Revolution. They try to rebuild their lives in America through the purchase of a house. That house once belonged to Kathy, a self-destructive alcoholic, played by Jennifer Connelly.
I grew up in this house. It's the house that my father left to me and my brother when he died. The county evicted me from this house by mistake, and your husband bought it, and now he won't sell it back for less than four times what he paid. If this goes to court, it could take
months.
They
are to deport us?
I don't know.
You must see. They will kill us. They will shoot my children.
You don't understand a word I'm saying to you.
Please. You are a very nice girl. Please, you write for me everything I want for to understand. For discussing with my husband. Okay.
Okay.
That searing performance earned Aghdashloo an Oscar nomination.
It's unbelievable. Absolutely. It's a timeless classic. When I first read it, I had a meeting with the writer.
That writer is Massachusetts novelist André Dubuque III.
As soon as I opened the door, I was expecting an elderly gentleman. It was a young man. I said, André? He said, yes. I said, you're so young. And he said, why? I said, the script has been written so wisely. And whoever has written it is so familiar with us, with the Persians, with our culture. And he said, no, I wrote it myself. And I'm like, you did an amazing job. Where were you? Behind the door or under the table? You know everything about us. And it was so close to my heart and so close to home that portraying this character not only made me proud when I was doing it, but it's made me proud for the rest of my life.
Shireh Aghdashloo was born in Tehran in 1952. Her mother adored Western literature and movies, and it inadvertently nurtured Aghdashloo's love of acting.
All I heard my childhood was Daphne, Emily, Charlotte, and these are Bronte sisters whom my mother is in love with. It was my mother who made me to watch Western films, especially American classics. That's why when I told my mother after watching Gone with the Wind in the Caspian Sea with the whole family, I told my mother that this is it. I want to be an actor. I want to portray characters like Scarlett O'Hara. And my mother said, forget it. While under you are under our roof, you should forget about this idea. And I said, why? Why are you so afraid of me becoming an actress?
You go to cinema every day. You read books every night. Why don't you want me to be a part of it? And she said, Iran is different. This is not Switzerland, sorry. You know.
She defied her parents and began acting at age 18. Agdashloo became a superstar in Iran. But in 1979, the Ayatollah Khomeini rose to power in the Islamic Revolution. Agdashloo writes in her memoir, The Alley of Love and Yellow Jasmine, that, quote, Tehran is shrouded in tear gas and smoke. There's fire everywhere. Our city is painted the color of orange and red. Agdashloo says she was a liberated woman, so there was no place for her in the Ayatollah's Iran. She fled, leaving her first husband and her parents and her brothers behind.
I did. I'm afraid I had to. There are times that you have to do it for the sake of your own people, not just for your own family. I knew that I was going to put them in harm's way if I had stayed in Iran. There was no place for an outspoken actress like myself and there an Islamic Republic in Iran.
Okay, wow.
You know, I cannot shut up. That's my problem.
No. Definitely not a problem. We need more outspoken, passionate people, if you ask me.
That's why I decided to leave, and I did not see my family for almost 10 years. Therefore, I jumped into my car 4 a.m. and left Iran, driving to the U.K.
Driving to the U.K.?
I did drive to the U.K., yes, from Tehran to Istanbul, Yugoslavia. Then I went to Venice, from Venice to south of France, Paris, Paris, Calais, London. I sold my car, I sold my jewelries, and I started studying politics. One thing that I had no knowledge of, and I wanted to get myself educated. I turned myself into an actress with a mission. I always wanted to be a part of a meaningful, substantial storytelling that would be sort of enlightening, educational, and helpful to the people more than anything else.
An actress on a mission. Sheree Agdashloo says this is what drives her diverse American acting career, which, by the way, she basically had to build from the ground up after fleeing Iran. She says it also explains why she's taken so many fascinating roles in science fiction projects, from the X-Men to Star Trek Beyond to her current high-profile project, the Sci-Fi Channel's epic series, The Expanse.
You know, with science fictions and animations, we can be free in what we're talking about without being worried about offending people. We can talk about stories that we are dealing with now in today's world and put it into a science fiction that takes place in 100 years and make people to watch and understand what is going on in a metaphorical way or in a symbolical way, which I love and adore.
In the world of The Expanse, humanity has colonized the solar system, in part through the naked exploitation of other humans. There's also considerable political intrigue, shadowy corporate malfeasance, the threat of rebellion, and hostile alien life. Agdashloo plays Christian Avasarala, one of the most powerful politicians on Earth who will go to any length to save the planet, such as in this scene where she demands help from the family members of a fugitive corporate titan.
Tell his children that government is more powerful than any corporation. And the only reason they think it tilts the other way is because we poor public servants are always looking for some fat private sector's payoff down the road. But I'm not looking. And by the time they can pull the strings to force me out, it'll be too late. Their family will be ruined. Their mother, the children, their children, all of them, pariahs, outlaws, hunted and on the run for the rest of their days until we find them and nail each and every last one to the wall. Make sure you tell them that. This is one of my favorite monologues of all times, and I'm so proud and so honored to be able to say these words. This monologue reminds me a lot of my favorite hero, Elizabeth Warren. And I love the fact that Christian Abasarala is saying that she is a public servant, and this is who she should be, and she's so loyal to her people and to the public. That's why I'm so proud of this monologue.
Wow. So that is not an answer I expected at all. But in a way, it makes perfect sense, because politics is such a key and important part of the plot of The Expanse.
And when I started thinking about this character, and I started with Margaret Thatcher, Indira Gandhi, Benazir Bhutto, Hillary Clinton, and that's why I have the past, the present, and the future in mind. Past, just as a point of reference. For me, past is 1,000 years ago. I would never rely on it, never count on it, but I have it in mind. Present is what I can do for the future. Future is tomorrow. And that's why I'd rather focus on the present to be able to do something for the future.
Mm. And what's always attracted me very strongly to science fiction is that multiculturalism is just a fact. It's not portrayed as this big deal because, you know, as you're saying, it's a reflection of our present and definitely our future. What's it like to be part of an ensemble cast that is so diverse?
It's unbelievable. We enjoy this so much. We are different backgrounds, nationality, color of skin, accents. We're living peacefully, working peacefully, lovingly next to one another. You see, this is what's been happening in our society, at least in this advanced society here in the United States, for at least a couple of decades. My neighbors here are from Nigeria to the left, Canada to the right, France right in front of me. We don't see a lot of reflection of it on the silver screen. The reason is because of the fact that producers, executive producers, studios cannot trust in us. Those who are doing it are now seeing that how beneficial it is to both of us, to them and to us, to our society, to understand that this is not the future, it's now.
And if I may say, you also get to wear the most fabulous wardrobe on the show.
Oh, my God.
I just had to get that in there. The beautiful, it looks like saris or a little South Asian influence, and you're the most colorful person in every scene.
In fact, Abasarala is the only character that wears color in The Expanse.
Wow. You know, hearing the story of what propelled you to leave Iran and the fact that ever since then you've been an artist on a mission, in a way it's making me look at your remarkable career in almost a brand new light. Where do roles such as when you were on the Fox series 24 back in 2005, you played the role of a terrorist. Where does that fit into your actress on a mission?
It was the first role of a terrorist that I accepted to portray for its versatility and also for its dimensions. She was a woman, she was a mother, she was a lover, she was a terrorist, she was a believer, she was a religious woman. And I just loved it. And I thought, I could be so useful here. Nobody has ever paid any attention to these mothers who are raising these terrorists. Who are they? Where are they? What kind of a frame of mind they have? Why their sons turn into terrorists? Why do they want to destroy the world rather than building it up? And I'm very proud of this character.
Yeah. I mean, we should remind folks that you did receive some pretty vociferous criticism from people in Iran for the fact that you did choose to play that character on 24. But I wonder, if a similar role were offered you today, would you take it?
I would definitely take it again, yes. Just to bring greater clarity to what is going on in today's world. I would definitely be interested in getting to know her character, her background, her family. Where is she coming from? Why is she turning her son into a traitor, into a terrorist, rather than into a hero?
Mm. Now, is there a role that you'd like to take or want to be offered that would really help get you further down the road of being an artist, an actress on a mission? What would help you fulfill your mission?
Well, absolutely. There are three roles that I am dying to portray. Indira Gandhi, Benazir Bhutto, Kiran Bedi, the first policewoman in India. She's now my age.
Really?
Yes. And I like to be a part of a story that will bring light into people's life, that will be educational down the road, that will help us to understand one another and hopefully love each other more than we do right now.
Well, I'm hoping that an ambitious young screenwriter or director heard you when you said you wanted to do Indira Gandhi or Benazir Bhutto, because I would love to see that film myself.
Honestly, I was thinking the same thing. I'm just praying to God for that. Yes.
Well, Shorey Ugdashlu is an Emmy-winning and Academy Award-nominated actress. She stars in the Sci-Fi Channel's series The Expanse. She also has a new film on the way. It's called The Promise, which comes out in April. Shorey, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Likewise, thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor and a pleasure.